ॐ वसुदेवसुतं देवं कंसचाणूरमर्दनं देवकी परमानन्दं कृष्णं वन्दे जगद्गुरु। So we are studying the 12th chapter, Bhakti Yoga. And actually last time, in spite of my best efforts, I was unable to conclude. But it's good, because then I can dwell in a sort of relaxed way on the last three verses. Actually, the 18th and 19th, the 20 verses, and 18th and 19th verse. A lot of things to be said there. Big picture first. 18 chapters, I've mentioned this many times. One way of looking at it is the whole of the Gita teaches the Advaitic truth. Tattvamasi, that you are. Now, we are coming to Holi and the birthday of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which we will celebrate, which we will observe on Sunday. They will say exactly the opposite of what I just said. You know, that you are. They'll say it's a foolish statement. How dare you say that you are one with God? You are not one thing, you are not that. There is a bhajan of the Vallabha sect, the Shuddhadvaita, Pushti Marga, where it says, why do you practice these paths of sadhana, nija sharira damana karat? You would try to restrain the body, the senses, discipline. Why? What's wrong with that? Murakha jana, foolish people. Tyaja nija ananda, that is the joy, the bliss which is already there in the form of Krishna in your heart. You have taken your mind away from that and you are delving into these abstract philosophies and trying these extraordinarily difficult paths. Something that's directly and continuously available if you would just have but faith. Look inwards and with faith, look to God, to the beloved Krishna within. So yes, that's another way of approaching the whole thing. But the framework that we have taken up, the non-dualistic framework, there you would say that the whole of the Gita, it's so many teachings are there. But one way of organizing the whole thing would be, you are that, the ultimate reality, that's the teaching. And the first six chapters, Krishna has shown us that we are not the body, not the mind. We are this immortal witness consciousness, the Atman. Body and mind are ever changing. Body is perishable. The mind, the subtle body is ever changing, not perishable until one becomes enlightened. But we are this witness consciousness. That is not born, that does not die, that does not suffer old age and disease and death with the physical body, that it does not suffer ups and downs with the frustrations and unhappiness and the miseries and the depressions of the mind. That is the ever pure, ever shining witness consciousness, and we are that already, and that has to be realized. And Krishna also taught the sadhana, the Vedantic sadhana for that, including karma yoga. He taught that in the second chapter, third chapter, fourth chapter, how to transform our daily life into spiritual practice. He did not tell Arjuna that if you want to realize the ultimate truth, that you are Brahman, you have to give everything up and go into the mountains and meditate, which Arjuna was ready to do. Krishna says, no, it's something that everybody can do. And the life which we have right now, how to transform that into spiritual practice, the karma yoga. Then the next six chapters, from chapter 7 to 12, which we are doing now, is about that. That what? See, our entire experience of the world is this too, subject and object. That's how we experience the world. Anybody, doesn't require you to be a spiritual seeker, believer. All of us, epistemology, knowledge is always subject and object. I and everything else. And what is spirituality? Spirituality investigates into what I really am and what this everything else really is. So in the first six chapters, Krishna has shown us that we are really this immortal self, Atman. As Vivekananda says, spirit, never, never matter changing. That's what we are, spirit. And then what about this, everything else, this entire universe? So all the theistic religions of the world will say that there is a spiritual power behind this world. Every religion which believes in God will say this: God is the creator and preserver of this world. So that power behind this world, behind means which is the source of this world, which is foundational, fundamental in this everything we are talking about, that is called God. And this chapter 7 to 12 are about God. And then we were introduced, Krishna introduced us to various levels of understanding of God. First is the most basic, personal God, as is taught in any religion. You know, for example, I might say, right in the Gita here. Here, who is God? God is Krishna. What exactly do you mean by Krishna? This person, you know, the personal God, who has come as an incarnation in front of us, and then also exists in an eternal form, is a personal God, but only this one. Then a higher and deeper conception of God would be God, who is an impersonal principle with enough scope for all personalities. So there is a power behind this universe, the creator, preserver, and destroyer of this universe. Non-anthropomorphic. An abstract, impersonal principle. But also all persons are included. See, many people think that if God is impersonal, existence, consciousness, bliss, with the power of Shakti, creating, preserving, destroying this world. But what about my beloved Krishna, my Rama? A Christian might say, my Jesus Christ, what about that? It's not excluded. Why should it be excluded? After all, if that power is behind everything, we are all persons, aren't we? So if that power can create us as persons, why can it not also come to the world as a person? It can. Yeah. So it comes once in a while as the divine incarnations. So that is the second conception of God. God as the Almighty, you know, omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent, impersonal, personal, creator, preserver, destroyer of this universe. What am I saying? I'm just giving you the basic idea of God in all theistic religions. That's the second, higher idea of God. That's higher than the, higher means more wider and more inclusive than the narrow one idea of God which I have in my doctrine, my teaching, in my religion. It's been taught to me. This is and nothing else. No. All of these are included in this higher idea of God. And then you go even further. That higher idea of God is in and through this cosmos, not only transcendent, but also immanent. Vivekananda says, we Hindus worship a transcendent, immanent God. Transcendent beyond time, space, causation. Untouched by this cosmos. Immanent in and through this cosmos. Everything here is imbued with the divine presence. So that is the 10th and 11th chapters which we saw. God appearing as the cosmos. The tremendous vision. Very poetic chapter, 11th chapter. And then beyond that also, there is a first, a second, third, and there's a fourth conception of God which we talked about. That is the identity of this and that. Who am I? What is all this? Ultimately, you come to a non-dual identity. That this, in this and this, this one and that one, they are one and the same reality. If you would know them as they truly are. That the teaching of that thou art. That is the highest reading of quote-unquote God. And now we are coming to the conclusion of the 12th chapter, where Bhakti Yoga, Krishna is taking up this question of how do you love God and whom does God love? Or what does God want in us to make us more lovable for God? God loves us in spite of everything, just as parents love their children in spite of everything. But if you're a nice kid, your parents maybe love you just that little bit more. If you're a little nice, if you're a good boy or a good girl. So how do you be a good boy or a good girl for in the eyes of God? It's tough, as you can see. The list of the ask from our divine parent is long. And you notice how much these qualities are the qualities of the jnani, of the person on the path of non-dual wisdom. How almost similar they are for the bhakta, for the devotee, and for the jnani, on the path of knowledge. 18 and 19. You can repeat after me if you like. Samau shatrau cha mitre cha. Samau shatrau cha mitre cha. Tatha manapamanayo. tathamanapamanayo shitoshna sukha dukkheshu shitoshna sukha dukkheshu samasanga vivarjitah tulya ninda stutir mauni santushto yena kenachit aniketa sthiramati bhaktiman me priyo narah. Alike to foe and friend, in honor and dishonor, in heat and cold, happiness and misery, free from attachment, alike in praise and censure, reticent, satisfied with anything, without a home, steady in mind, such a devoted person is dear to me. This is a long list. Starts with samaha. Samaha means same. Same where? Shatro cha mitre cha, for to friend and foe alike. Mana apamana, in honor and dishonor alike. Same, samaha. Shitoshna, samaha, heat and cold, or whatever natural conditions. Samaha, same. Sukha dukkha, in happiness and in pain, in pleasure and pain. Samaha. Sangha varjitaha, and detached from all the pairs of opposites, ups and downs of life. Samaha, serene and sane, same. So this samaha, how does it work? If we just contemplate the world before us, look at the five elements, space. Space is the same to all of us, friend and foe, whether you like space or you do not like space. Space is the same. It will give you space anyway. It gives, look at the sky, bright blue sky, no clouds, same space. Cloudy, white, fluffy clouds, same space. Dark storm, same space. We had a very interesting sky in New York last year, I think, when the Canadian wildfires were there. So it became red, sort of apocalyptic. And they were locusts, not locusts exactly, they were these little insects also. Somebody said the biblical prophecies have come true. There are locusts. And the sky is the same. That's that sky and this sky right now, whether it's day or dark night, the same space. It is samaha all the time. But so is are the other elements, whether it is air or it allows you to breathe and exist. Human beings, good and bad, plants and animals, and all of us, same air. Then water and fire and earth, these basic elements are the same for everyone. What am I trying to say? But we, every one of us, we are all physically constituted of those same basic elements. How do we have so much of likes and dislikes? Everything in the world is constituted of the same basic elements. Prakriti, nature, is samaha for all of us. And we are made of the same things. Our minds are also made of this, of materials. You know, in Vedanta, the mind is also material. It's a product of subtler aspects of matter, sukshma. Go a little deeper. The Vedantin goes a little deeper. All these five elements and all, where have they come from? Maya, the power of God. Maya is basically the power of the absolute to appear as this universe. So it's a power of appearance. The entirety of the world, with all its highs and lows, goods and good and bad, is basically a movie playing out on the screen of God. Samaha, in a movie you are the same. You understand what is nice, what is not nice, who is a hero and a villain, and you enjoy and you identify. You may cry and shout and laugh and react in horror. All of those things are there. At the same time, even while you are reacting to the movie, you are still samaha. Because basically you know these are pictures. Whatever happened in the dream, when you wake up and you look back upon the dream, what is your attitude? Samaha, same, towards all of it. Exactly like that, the jnani, the one of knowledge, looks upon this, the display of this world with samaha. It's an appearance, it's a dream, it's a magic show, it's like a movie. This is a deeper understanding. We are going once deeper than what? First, we went from our samsara to basic material reality, the five elements. Then we went deeper into Maya. These five elements are nothing but Maya, an appearance. You can treat it as a dream. If you treat it as a dream, if you treat it as a movie, if you treat it as a theatrical performance, it's samaha. For you, basically, even if you understand the entire plot and you have likes and dislikes, but deep inside, for a movie or a theatrical performance, what is your attitude? One of equanimity. After all, you will say, it's a performance. Go even deeper. Final analysis. What is all this? Brahman. One limitless existence consciousness place. This itself is Brahman. Oh, that's too much. I can't treat good and bad as the highest ultimate reality. I don't understand it. All right. Step back. A little concession. Treat it as Maya, an appearance, a dream. No, it's not a dream. It's real. All right. Treat it as real nature. But treat it as matter and energy. The play of matter and energy. The play of five elements. The Sanskrit word prapancha. It means the five elements in detail. Five in detail is prapancha. What is five in detail? This. What are the five? Space, air, fire, water, earth, the ancient cosmology of the universe. Now we have the huge, much more complicated periodic table. But that's also very neutral. There is no good and bad there. There is no evil, no friend and foe there. No. It is samaha. So whether you treat it as material nature, or you look deeper and see Maya, appearance everywhere, a play, a movie, an illusion, or you go further, it's no longer a play, it's no longer a movie, it's very real, but a divine reality. Then also, in every level, it is samaha. That is a jnani, the path of knowledge. The devotee, will not say it's a dream, he will say it's real, but it's a play of God, it's leela, it's not samsara. We say it's samsara, a problematic state of existence. From the perspective of the enlightened one, it is leela, the play of God, a divine play. Swami Turiyananda used to say, attain jivan mukti, become free in this life, realize that you are Brahman. And then, what's next? Spend the rest of this limited existence, as long as the body lives, spend it as a play with the divine mother. For him, God was mother. The entire universe is a play of the mother. Play your role as best as you can. You are the child of the mother. The rest of this particular life. As if it's so easy. Become a jivan mukta. Become an enlightened while living. As if it's just something, get it done with, over with. Samaha. Samaha for what? Shatro cha mitre cha. For friend and enemy. These are constructs of the mind. See, the same person, the same object, the same food, the same job, the same place and climate, which you one may not like at all. One may dislike it. Notice how many other people like it. How many other people praise it. How many other people are comfortable with it. So it's in my mind. It's not really out there. Almost all of these things, what we like and dislike so much, our strong likes and dislikes are what make friends and enemies. These are our constructions. These are mental. They are not really outside. And for a spiritual person, often an enemy is much more, so-called enemy, is much more helpful than a friend. There are three levels of dealing with this. Vyavahara, bhava, jnana. So jnana means knowledge. At our deepest understanding, what is our understanding of the so-called friend and enemy? That they are Brahman. The person who has studied and grasped Vedanta in depth cannot deny it anymore. It is, veritably, the divinity in that form. Why is the divinity acting so awfully? Miserable. It's because of the lens through which the light is coming. The lens too is divine. But that's the play. Lens of what? Lens of this particular personality. It's the same limitless consciousness, refracted through, limited through the mind of here. This personality called Sarva Priyananda. We think it's a person. No, it's an impersonal reality coming through a limited personality. Shining through a limited personality. What are we? The limited personality or that impersonal reality? We are that impersonal reality. Many such persons we have been in the past. And we will yet continue to be as long as you want to play this game. Yeah. come into this, what the poet calls the veil of tears, again and again. So, jnana, by knowledge we know I am Brahman, and all of these, my so-called enemy and so-called friend are Brahman, none other than God, or play of God, Leela, whichever way, depending on your attitude. Are you a devotee, a lover of God, or are you knower of God? Knower means in the sense of jnani. The difference is this, that there are these two terms, tat and tvam, that and you. That means Brahman. You means you. The whole Bhagavad Gita we are analyzing in those terms. The first six chapters, discussion about our real nature, discussion about you, what you are. Next six chapters, which we are concluding now, discussion about that, about God. And the last six chapters will be the identity of the two. So jnana, the path of knowledge, establishes, it shows you the identity, that ultimately in its depth, in its finality, they are one and the same. I always quote Meister Eckhart's, you know, the ground of God and the ground of my soul are one and the same ground. This is exactly what Advaita wants to say. But if you don't want to go so far, if you want to maintain your individuality and the personality of God, then instead of saying that and this, tattvam, are one identity, you can set up a relationship between tat and tvam, between that and you, a relationship of love, of surrender, of discipleship, of friendship, of service. That is bhakti. That's all. These are two formats. So in the mind you have the knowledge, I am Brahman, the so-called enemy, so-called friend is Brahman. That's one, at the highest level, jnana. Next level, bhava. What is my mental attitude and affect? Affect meaning emotion. So notice, my attitude and my affect, they differ from, if I consider a person to be an enemy, if I consider a person to be a friend, they differ sharply. But if my knowledge is, they are ultimately one divine reality, my affect will be much more samaha. I will not have a strong reaction of dislike for a person, or a food, or an activity, or a place, or a job. No. I will also inquire, why do I have this strong liking for this person, or this food, or this place? No. In both cases, my affect will be far more serene. A devotee will have the same feeling of love towards everybody. Even for the person who considers oneself the enemy of the devotee, the true bhakta, lover of God, will have a feeling of love towards that. The effect, emotion within, will be one of acceptance and love. It's very difficult to be an enemy of a saint. Very difficult. It's hard work. I've seen this again and again. My reaction is of an ordinary person. But I've seen a senior monk reacting to, say, a troublemaker as somebody, a visitor from outside, troublemaker. I was amazed to see the affectionate, fatherly reaction. And that boy, within a couple of days, has now become dedicated volunteer of the ashrama, where he himself had come with an adversarial view. And now he's become a volunteer. How? It's because of that loving and accepting view. You genuinely feel this person is on my side. So, samaha, the bhava, the mental effect is one of acceptance, the emotion is of acceptance, of love, of seeing greatness even in the smallest good quality of that person. See, enmity and friendship, what they do is, when I have a feeling of friendship with somebody, the defects are suppressed and the good qualities become magnified in my eyes, immediately. Of a person, of a place, of anything, of a job. And when I don't like it, or like the person, or the place, or whatever it is, then the defects become magnified. And in the eyes of a devotee, all the good things of that person, or that place will become, or that job will become magnified. That how good it is, you know, for my spiritual life. So that the person is like this. So bhava. And then vyavahara. How do you actually behave with people, this as a devotee? So vyavahara, you have to be skillful. You can't be the same to everybody. So somebody who is a devotee of the Lord, a saintly person, you will behave in a particular way. Somebody who is a stranger, somebody who is very friendly and helpful to you, somebody who is aggressive and non-cooperative and difficult, you'll have to behave skillfully. Behind that skillful behavior will be the bhava, the attitude of acceptance and well-wisher. I am on your side, let me see what I can do for you. And behind that, deeper than that, is the jnana. It is all Brahman. This is my service of the divinity in this form. So, shatro cha mitre cha, for enemy and for friend, is internal. It's entirely a constitution of our mind. For the saint, there is no enemy actually, from the perspective of the saint. The enemy might be confirmed as an enemy of the saint, but from the perspective of the saint, there is really no enemy. They genuinely pray for people who directly do harm to them. Because from in their vast vision, their vision is so vast, this person is just, you know, a godchild for them, blossoming forth, and your duty as this saintly devotee is to help this person along the fastest path to their growth. It might include scolding also, might include disciplining, or it might include love and inspiration. Then, tatha mana apamana yoho, in honor and in dishonor. Saint Francis, I love that little book, the little flowers of Saint Francis of Assisi. So, his disciples, those who came to be monks under him, he would send them out to difficult places, you know, where people would dishonor them and insult them. One of them, I think it Brother Bernard was, I've forgotten, who was a rich man. And Saint Francis said, if you want to be my disciple, first you have to go out into the town square and give away everything that you possess. And humble yourself before the townsfolk so that when they laugh at you and they mock you and all, you must be full of prayer in your mind. And joyful. So why do that? This mana apamana, honor and dishonor, alike in honor and dishonor. Saint Francis himself, one story I loved reading about him was how one of his, when he was quite famous, one of his brother disciples, the name of the story is Why You? The brother disciple said to Saint Francis, Why You? Why are you the most well known among all of us? Why are you the most famous and beloved among all of us? You are not from a wealthy house like other. He was from a pretty well-off house actually, but not like noble born like such and such person. Another monk. You're not like that. You're not the most learned among us. There are so many. You are hardly learned at all. You are not the most eloquent speaker. See, this person is more than you. You're not the most handsome and good-looking among all the brothers. See, that person is. So you are like average to poor in everything. And yet, why you? Saint Francis went into an ecstasy there. And he communed with God as he would. And he came back and he told his brother, you are right, my brother. I am this, what you say, because I am the least of you. I am not learned. I am not handsome. I am not an eloquent speaker. I am not this, I am not that. He goes on and he says, it is just because I am like this, God shows with the least of things he can achieve glorious things. If the grace of God is there, the glorious things can be achieved. It is not our personal qualities which are important. For the world it might be important. In the eyes of God, it's nothing. If God wants to achieve great things through you, he will. He'll pick up the least one amongst you and achieve the greatest thing through you. It's just because I am the least among you, the most useless among you. That's why God has used me for this. Like Brother Lawrence, who was in the kitchen. Yes, practice of the presence of God. So why you? Mana apamana yo. Honor and dishonor are alike. Manusmriti has also pointed out that a true Brahmana, spiritual seeker, true Brahmin, is the one who is carefully avoids all mana, all respect and honor. Is extremely wary of people honoring him. And extremely humble. And accepts all criticism and dishonor happily. That's, he says, Manusmriti says, true Brahmin. Why? Because if you get honor, you see, all your tapasya, your spiritual practices are lost. If you get dishonor, your spiritual, the power of your spiritual practices, it increases. You want to realize God, and that the way to realize God is through spiritual practice, the potency of your spiritual practice, your spirit, and that is, it blazes forth when you are subjected to dishonor and to criticism, negativity. And it's lost when people are nice to you. When are people nice to you? One of the best ways you can, one of the easiest ways to spend your karmic credit is to be famous. Facebook likes, you know. Be careful. All good karma is being used up that way. If you are famous. People like you. They love you. They adore you. You are popular. Be very careful. Bad days are coming. Because all the good that you would have got from your good karma is being used up now. It's just being used up. One senior Swami was criticized by a junior monk, and other Swamis were furious about it. I've forgotten the details of this, but the story outline is this. Other Swamis were furious and said, "Swami, why don't you scold that person?" And this Swami, he said, "Oh, why should I? He has done me a great favor. Look, by subjecting me to this criticism, he has destroyed my past karma, my bad karma. And why should I think of punishing him? Because he has taken upon himself all the bad karma of criticizing me. So he has done me a great favor." Mana apamana, honor and dishonor. See, there are four categories of human beings in a spiritual, from a spiritual classification, point of view of spiritual practice. It's called Pamara, which is an instinctive life. The word Sanskrit word Pamara means uncivilized, uncultured, instinctive, almost animal-like, brutish. Pamara. The little better than that is Vishayi. Vishayi means a worldly person. With a sense of honor. The uncultured person and the uncivilized person is also a worldly person. But the Vishayi is what is called Marjita, Dharmika worldly. That means has a sense of good and bad. A sense of decency. A sense that this is my level. I will not go below this. Most people are like that. And they have strong worldly goals. And they also like to think, we also like to think of ourselves as moral and, yes, religious and good people. Most people like to think of ourselves as good people. Others may not think of us as good people, but we think of ourselves as good people. That's that second level. And then higher than that is a spiritual seeker, sadhaka. A spiritual seeker. And as you can see, in each level there is a whole spectrum. It's not just one. There is a whole spectrum there. So spiritual seeker. Sadhaka. And then the highest, of course, is Siddha. Siddha is the perfected one. So four categories. Why am I saying this? Now apply this in terms of mana apamana, honor and dishonor, praise and criticism. This is the lowest, the instinctive, almost animalish. That person goes around seeing dishonor everywhere, criticism everywhere, negativity everywhere. It is extremely ready to see negativity in others. Chip on shoulder, what is the term? Chip on the shoulder. Then higher than this, so this is also a sign of tamas, of a tamasic mind, of a dark mind. Then higher than this is the worldly person, the regular world person in the world you see. Such persons are a combination of both. They recognize dishonor, insult where they see it, and they get angry about it, they try to avoid it, they try to hit back when they see that, and they recognize praise and honor where they see it, and they like it, and they try to get it, and they reciprocate. So you give respect to those who respect you, and you insult or dislike those who insult you or dislike you. That is worldly. Then the sadhaka, next level, the spiritual seeker, is just the reverse of this worldly person. Is a person who is happy when that person, when he or she is criticized and put down, insulted, good, and is extremely wary and careful and uneasy if the person is praised and extolled and adored. No, this is not good. So both ways. You see the difference between the sadhaka and the vishayi? The worldly person likes praise of other people and extremely disturbed by the criticisms of other people. The sadhaka tries to be careful about avoiding the praise and is uncomfortable with being praised and does not want this attention and praise and adulation and fame, rather takes the criticism and all in good spirit and tries to see, is there anything in it that I can do? And what about undeserved criticism? And the sadhaka will say, even better. All my bad karma is being wiped out. They are very strange stories. Especially great spiritual masters, they were great for scoldings. And we have seen that sometimes the bad karma of people in front, it was removed by the scolding. It was a completely unfair scolding. But something else happened. Maybe the person went forward in spiritual life. And one of the silliest, cutest stories I heard was, this monk who was a very good monk and served Swami Brahmananda, he had only one defect. Just one defect. His joints cracked when he moved. You know, like this one. Yes. And people, all the others thought, okay, it's a little annoying, but it's not a habit. It's nothing that he can do about it. It's just one day, and it's recorded. And it reminisces, one day Swami Brahmananda scolded him intensely and quite unfairly. And we thought, what's going on? And he says, mysteriously, from that time onwards, all his joints stopped cracking. Now you make of it what you will. This is quite a silly story, but it's therefore more serious things when a person who has got stuck in the spiritual progress, who's not going ahead, or is slipping back in spiritual life, and a sudden scolding, which might sound unfair for the most trivial of things, but the effect is the person's, somehow the floodgates open, and the person goes forward in spiritual life again. Sama, this mana apamanaya, very careful about what is actually honor, might be quite unhelpful in spiritual life. What seems to be criticism might be very helpful in spiritual life. Then what about the highest level? Siddha, the perfected one, does not care. Is not going to search out for praise or going to search out for criticism. It makes no difference at all. It makes no difference at all. Is happy with both. If you praise him, he'll be happy like a child. If you criticize him, equally happy like a child. It does not take to heart any of them. I've mentioned Ramana Maharshi's story about somebody writing an article to criticize him, and then he sends him the copy of the article, and Ramana Maharshi carefully edited, corrected the spelling mistakes and grammar and sent it back to him, and somebody said, but he is criticizing you, and Ramana Maharshi's answer is not that, oh, I don't mind, or I'm above it. He said, no, not at all. He's criticizing some fellow called Ramana. So strong is the identity with the background existence, consciousness, bliss, the self as pure awareness. This little personality is nothing. You might as well be an actor playing a wonderful role in on Broadway, and then theater critic writes how you played this nasty character to perfection, and you're delighted because it's your high praise for you because you have acted well. You are not affected by the role itself. Mana apamana yoho, samaha, same. Shitoshna, this also I mentioned last time. Heat and cold, same. Heat and cold, how can you be same? Doesn't it have to be at 72 degrees all the time? It can't be below that, can't be above that. No, it's good to be tough in those ways. Not just heat and cold. All worldly, the natural environment, good to be even physically a little samaha about it, as far as you can. India, I mentioned, is a hot country. So we are always full of awe at the yogis who live in the Himalayas. And we always feel how they live in the midst of snows and ice. At least at one time, most Indians had never seen snow or ice. I remember, even when I was a young novice, when I joined the order, any senior monk who went on a tour of some cold country in Europe or America, one of the, so they would come back and there would be a storytelling session. Now the younger generation of monks are no longer interested. If I go to India and if I say I'm going to tell you stories about the United States, nobody's interested because they all know much more now. I mean, it's all, we're all interconnected, you know, and the world is a much smaller place. They've already seen it. What's there to hear? But when even up to our time, it was very entertaining and nice. So I remember we would listen with awe when the Swamis talked about seeing snow on the road in front of you. I never saw snow in front of me. Even when I went to the Himalayas, it was in the summer. So the snow was on the mountain peaks, not in the valleys. First time I saw snow right in front of me was in New Zealand. And in summer, which is winter for them. So how the yogis live in this cold, in the middle of snow? That's amazing. But what is also true is that some of those yogis can't bear the heat of the plains. Some, there are yogis in the plains who cannot bear the cold of the mountains. The ideal is to put up with both. If cold is your comfort zone, then you're not doing much of tapasya, of austerity, living in a cool and pleasant place. If heat is your comfort zone, then you're not doing much of an austerity remaining in the plains of India. But in either case, if you're fine and uncomplaining, physically you may suffer. You can't stop the body from suffering. Krishna says in the second chapter itself, Arjuna thinks, all right, you are saying I am this witness consciousness, but all right, but for the body, this personality, this will suffer in this world. There is heat and cold, there is pain and there is disease and old age. So what about that? And Krishna says straight away, Tan titikshasva bharata, forbear, put up with them. The ups and downs of the world, he says, they come and go. You have to be patient with them. So there is no spiritual solution. You can use some technology. You can put air conditioning in. It will help a little bit. That's all. Samaha, shitoshna, samaha. I told you about my friend, the monk, who went to the senior monk and asked for, in the heat of summer in Calcutta, I want to go to the mountains. And the head monk said, all right, you can go. And this monk, the young monk, it escaped him. He blurted out, thank God, I really want to go there. It's too hot here, I can't bear it. And he was in for a whole lot of trouble because the head monk really, what is the phrase, chewed him out on this. What do you mean? Is that why you want to go to the mountains? I thought you want to go for meditation. You can't bear it. What do you mean you can't bear it? What about all the poor people out on the street who are laboring day and night, who are pulling the rickshaws? And just outside the monastery, what about the old and the sick monks who lie in the heat in this monastery room? Aren't they bearing it? Aren't you ashamed of saying that you can't bear it? That's why you would. Then he said, then why have you come to be a monk? The gate is open, you can leave. Luckily, he was not thrown out. And he came and told me that I should have just kept my mouth shut when I got permission. Then he says, sukha dukkheshu samaha, same in pleasure and pain. How can you be same in pleasure and pain? Sukha and dukkha, happiness and misery. It just doesn't seem right. How can you? In misery, you'll be miserable. In happiness, you'll be happy. How can you be in same to both? See, this sukha and dukkha, this happiness and misery, pain and pleasure, these are what is called manasankalpita. They are imaginations of the mind. They are phantasms. There's an interesting point, I'll point it out to you. It's a deep insight. They are not even as real as this material world. Notice, the material world, this table, it's made of physical stuff. If I go into a dream and dream about this table, that table will not be made of wood. The one, it was in my dream, that would be made of a mind, of imagination. The mind visualized a table, projected a table. It's not even physical, material. What's the point? The point is this. However, the pain and pleasure I feel here, I feel it as a real pain and pleasure. And the pain and pleasure we feel in dreams, we also feel that as a real pain and pleasure. Even when we wake up, We are relieved. Oh, thank God it wasn't real. But it still feels awful to have suffered anxiety. Sometimes people have anxiety dreams and things like that, you know. So the circumstances become falsified when you wake up. Oh, there was nothing wrong. It was a dream. But the feeling doesn't be falsified, you know. You still felt awful there. That shows this pain and pleasure, sukha and dukkha, they ride on the mind, or specifically the ego. When I experience a table here, I see the table. I don't say I am the table. That sounds ridiculous. Even when we say the body, the physical body, experience the body, and I say I am the body, but I don't literally mean that. It seems very odd to say I am a bone and a little bit of skin and hair. No. It can say my body, my table. But when I say I'm happy, I am happy. I don't say I'm the witness of happiness. I am experiencing a feeling of happiness. I am the witness consciousness. We don't say that. I am happy. I am miserable. See how the ego is completely entwined with happiness and misery. Happiness and misery come into our awareness riding on the ego. As the ego is a projection in the mind, an activity of the mind, so is happiness and misery activity of the mind. Something that is so important to us. Our feelings of happiness, our feelings of misery. Something that we want to avoid completely, misery and pain. Something we really want more and more and more of, pleasure and happiness. Entirely projections of the mind. They come with the mind, especially with the ego, and they go with the ego. The ananda of Brahman, that ananda is not this worldly happiness. So this is an important insight. The so-called happiness and misery, which is so important to us in our lives, has all the reality of ghosts. They're ghosts in the mind. They come and go with mental activity, come and go with ego, egoic activity. You are the witness consciousness can immediately objectify. If you realize that you are the witness consciousness, clarity is there. If we take a stand on myself as the witness of all that is going on in the mind, in the body, in the world, then I will be able to see that the ego with its happiness and its misery, with its problems and its prospects, is also an object. It's something that's playing around. It's not me. That's an amazing realization. It's a ghost. As are its phantasms of happiness and misery. One sadhu put it beautifully. He said, just as parents don't give too much importance to the tantrums of children, little kid, sometimes he's screaming, sometimes laughing delightfully. You know, people are so happy to see the innocent laugh on the face of a little toddler. Yes, but the same toddler the next moment can scream his heart out, you know. For almost nothing. I saw in the airport once, a little kid in front of me sitting with his parents and playing happily. And then he had a chocolate bar which broke. Just the bar broke. He screamed, the entire terminal resounded with his screams. Is it such a tragedy? No, it isn't. Similarly, our so-called tragedies, upsets and terrible things in our life which we are so upset about and so delighted about, from a high spiritual perspective, they are like the children's tantrums. It's nothing to you. And it's also proved by the fact, even the most tremendous happiness and misery, after some time, it sort of fades away.
Even the grief we experience from a loss of a loved one.
Yes, even grief fades away. Even grief fades away. You would say that a healthy mind would actually be defined by, if it's prolonged grieving and not coming out, in psychology, even psychiatry would define it as a problem.
No, but that's it also from the ego.
It's also from the ego, yes. It's also from the ego. Why? You'd say, what about my parents, my brother, sister, husband, wife, children? Isn't their loss, their going away, death, their ill fortune, aren't they devastating? Yes, their experience is devastating. But notice, the entire relationship network I've set up is the ego, body and ego. Just straightforward. If I am the witness consciousness, as Shankaracharya says, who is your father, who is your mother, who is your brother, sister, husband and wife? Who? You're the same consciousness in all beings. And then you see the network of relationships will still remain, but you will see that from a distance. You'll say it'll still remain and you have to deal with it in life, but you have a detachment with it. And that's true. That's the truth. If you want to set up a relationship, set it up with God. Swami Ramsukh Das Ji put something very nice point. He said, Nitya or Anitya ka sambandh nahi hota hai. There is no real relationship between the eternal and the non-eternal. You, the eternal self, and the non-eternal world, and husband, and wife, and father, and mother, and children, and co-workers, and you, the body, and places, and gadgets, and possessions, they're all continuously changing. They are non-eternal, and you are the eternal self. There can be no real relationship between the two. Because that which is eternal, not changing, that which is continuously changing, how can you tie them together? It's like you're sitting quietly and there's somebody running around. If you try to grab hold of the running around, either you'll be dragged along or that one will stop. Now you as the self cannot be dragged along. You are always unchanging. The world cannot be stopped. It's always changing. So there is no real relationship. But it seems like we have so many relationships. And therefore, the Swami says, Ramsukh Das Ji, kalpit hai. They are imaginary. They are imagination born. I mean, this is all kind of monastic talk. Sometimes we are told not to say these things in front of householders, but just imagine this. Every relationship that we have in this life, right now, important one, at the moment of the death of the body, everything is gone. Everything is gone, except your relationship with God. Everything else. And when a person dies, you see, loss of a beloved one, all the relationships that the person had with us is gone. It's only in our memories that it continues. Not even in the memory of that one. It's gone. It's suppressed. That one will go on to other, you know, in its own spiritual path. The only relationship that one has is with God. Only relationship we have is with God. And what about each other? Through God. That's the real relationship we have. The deep relationship we have is the divinity in all beings. That's why Vedanta, I have said this often, Vedanta divinizes our human relationships and humanizes our divine relationship. Our relationship with God is humanized. My father, my mother, God is my father, God is my mother, God is my child, God is the Lord, I am the servant, God is my friend or beloved. These are all human relationships. And our relationship with human beings is divinized because in all these human beings dwells my beloved Lord. That's the devotee's approach. Or all of these human beings are that one same consciousness. Krishna will say this in the next chapter. I am the one consciousness in all beings. Sukha dukkheshu samaha. Sangha vivarjitaha. Devoid of attachment. Carefully stepping away from attachment. Krishna has already warned about attachment. Attachment means stickiness with people, with things, with ideas, all of that. Whatever is changing in the world, a stickiness. They'll all be there, but don't try to hold on, grasp. This attachment, it's a mental thing. It's all in our minds. So Krishna has warned in the second chapter what leads to completely the fall of the spiritual seeker. The fall of the spiritual seeker. Dhyayato vishayan pungsa sangaste shupajayate sangat sanjayate kama kamat krodho vijayate krodhat bhavati sammoha sammohat smriti vibhrama smritir bhangshat buddhi nasho buddhi nashat pranashyati. What does that mean? Second chapter. How is the spiritual seeker swept away by worldliness? Even if we are all advancing on the spiritual path, but we can fall. How? Dwelling continuously on objects of senses, on worldly things, worldly thoughts, worldly people, worldly activities, worldly projects, dwelling constantly on them. Then what happens? Sangha, an attachment, develops in the mind, a liking and attachment. Dwelling on their so-called good things, you know what, it's nice. Then, third, from attachment comes desire, sangat kama abhijayata, desire. I must have it, I must do this, I must go there. I must make friends with this person. So kama, desire. Then, when desire is frustrated, kamat krodho vijayate, anger. It's a flip side of desire, anger. And then, From anger, krodhat bhavati sammoha, delusion, a fog descends upon us. What is right and what is wrong? What's our goal in life? You see, why fog? Because later on, when we snap out of anger, when it diminishes, then we regret the things we said under the influence of anger, the things we did under the influence of anger, things we wrote. There's a saying, old saying, Shatam vada malika, say it 100 times, but never write it down when you are in anger. I remember reading about the Second World War, a senior officer of the British Air Force, I think, or the War Department, who had a lot of complaints against the way war was being run by Churchill and others. So he had these long memos, which he never sent any one of them. So whenever he got annoyed with the Prime Minister, he wrote a long letter criticizing everything, but he never sent it. But he maintained a meticulous file, which was of great use for researchers later on. But none of them were ever sent. So, in anger, fog descends upon us. And the proof of that, sammoha, delusion, the proof that it is delusion is that we regret it ourselves very soon. We regret it ourselves. Why did I say that? Why did I do this? Why did I even think like this about others? Why did I even feel like this about others? As good it, we regret it. It's a sign of a sensitive, it's a sign of a spiritually progressive person. The one who, what is the phrase? Doubles down, justifies. It's a weakness. I know something to be wrong, that's why I double down. And that is not a way out. One day I'll have to unravel it again. So it's better to regret it. And so that's anger. Then it leads to a cloud of delusion. Cloud of delusion, smriti nasha. This is memory is lost. Memory is lost means all my knowledge, all my practice, all my intentions. Lost means they're at least hidden for the time being. Then smriti bhangshat, buddhi nasha. The intellect fails. Wrong decisions are taken. We go out and do wrong things under the influence of anger and prompted by desire before that. And when you do that, smriti buddhi nashat pranashyati. The person, destruction comes. Destruction means we do not attain our goal in life. It could be definitely spiritual goal, but also worldly goals are not attained. Anybody who's angry has already lost. I remember when we were being trained in martial arts, fighting, actually physically fighting. The first teaching was never get angry. Very soon, you say, how can you not get angry when somebody is punching you? If you do get angry, they would make us stand and then the whole class would line up and each one would come and deliver their best punch, throw their best punch at. And you are not allowed. Your hands are put behind your back. You can't do anything. Take everything. Take everything that comes. At the end of it, you begin to see your own body as a part of a chess game. I remember this martial artist who would fight every day in the morning. So somebody asked him about it. He said, oh, unless I get punched a few times, I don't feel hungry for breakfast. You know, get ready for breakfast. Somebody has to hit me a few times. Then you realize even somebody hitting your body, it is get furious when somebody punches you or slaps you. There's strong body identification. Anyone who's a sportsman, you know, in all these combat sports, they know it's very easy to overcome. It's very easy to overcome this. That much detachment with the body. So, anger. Then, next. Yeah, so this is Sangha, the evil effects of attachment. Then it says, Tulya Ninda Stutir Mauni. For this person, Samaha, same evenness. Praise and criticism are the same. This is the more practical side or the verbal side of honor and dishonor. People praising you, people criticizing you. We are really eager to hear what people are saying about us. If it's praise, good, really we want to hear that. And if it's criticism, that also we want to hear. We are disturbed by it, but we can't help ourselves. What did he say about me? I remember once I was walking with this senior monk, my mentor, and there was a group of young men standing at one corner, part of the ashram. And the usual path we walked, he would teach us, the senior monk, and we were newcomers, new monks. That day suddenly he said, we will not take this path, we will go this way. I said, why? And he said, they're speaking about us, so we should not hear. We should not hear. Let's go this way. Another time, to my discredit, I have to say it, but it was a great lesson which I learned at the very beginning of my monastic life. At the very beginning, I was a few weeks into my monastic life. We had a very revered monk as the head of the ashram. And then I heard another monk criticizing. What the criticism was, I've forgotten already. But the lesson I got, I remember very clearly. I've forgotten the details completely. That's what happens often. I mean, suppose you lose your temper. Decades later, what the issue was, you've completely forgotten. The details have slipped. But that you were angry and you hurt somebody in your anger, that you can't forget. Similarly. So I was so disturbed. I was immature, disturbed by this criticism. Now I wouldn't react at all. I went and told another senior monk, a revered Swami, who was one of the tough guy Swamis, you know, very dynamic. I said, but I feel so awful that Swami is saying this about our revered head, Swami. And this Swami said, oh, he said this. We must immediately report it. Come with me. And I didn't want to do that. But he grabbed me and he dragged me to the lion's den. And then this Swami said to the head Swami, Maharaj, you know this boy? Just now he told me that such and such monk said such and such thing about you to him. Before he could complete, the head Swami sharply snapped at me. He said, why did you hear? You are the one encouraging this gossip. I don't know what to say. My mouth fell open, I think. He wasn't even interested in listening to what that monk had said about him. Absolutely nothing. All his ire was at me, not about that person who said something about him. No question. He wanted to teach me this lesson. He says, never ever complain. Never ever complain. Never carry, you know, one person's words to another person. And then, to his credit, the other monk who had dragged me in front, he was, of course, very honest about it. Oh, no, Swami, he didn't want to come. I pulled him. And he looked at me and said, go, go, go. go from here. So I made good my escape. Tulya ninda stuti mauni. Ninda and stuti. Ninda is criticism. Stuti is praise. It's same to them. They're equally disinterested. Mauni, silent. So speech. Silence is a very good practice for speech. What is the good, best way of speaking? Don't. You see, you have got only one tongue and 2 ears. Listen more than you speak. There is a formula. Hitam satyam cha hitam cha mitam cha. Speak the truth. Be quite clear that it's the truth. And then hitam. See, it's beneficial. It does good to somebody, somewhere. It's beneficial. Mitam, keep it short. So I remember we were trained in public speaking, not in the monastery, long before that, in college. So there are all these formulas. But one of the formulas which has stuck in my mind to give a good speech, what is the formula? Stand up, speak up, shut up. Another formula was, your speech should be exhausted before the audience is exhausted. Stand up, speak up, shut up. So speak less. Sometimes do not speak. So mauna literally means the vow of silence. So many yogis, especially the Hatha yogis and Patanjali yogis, they observe the vow of silence. A tremendous amount of energy is wasted in speaking. Speak physically, a lot of energy is wasted. Notice how when you're sick or when you're tired, you don't feel like talking. There's very little energy left. So a lot of energy is spent in talking. And then you notice how when you do talk a lot, sit quietly, you'll see how your mind is constantly chattering. That's also talk. That's also spending energy. If you must talk, recite hymns to the Lord, chant the mantra. That's the best use of the tongue, to talk. Satyam cha hitam cha mitam cha. So silence. But don't overdo it. As in all cases, be careful. Because it's a powerful energy and we are not used to controlling it. If you forcefully stop talking altogether, then there is a reaction. I have seen I'll just take a few minutes. I've seen, for example, one monk, I had gone to an ashram, and that night I was a guest monk, and another guest monk was there, was in the next bed in the same room. Now that monk didn't speak. He was under a vow of silence. But all night long he spoke. He mumbled to himself all night long. See, it's repression. If you don't speak for months and years together, he doesn't know it. Next morning I said, Swami, he talks with gestures. Swami, you were speaking last night, and he went like this. Who, me? No. So that's repression. Don't. Another monk, a very dear, lovely soul, who went 10 years without speaking. And he would convey what he wanted with gestures and all. But when he did break his vow of silence, oh my God, he was a terror. In the ashrams, we would be scared that Swami is coming to visit. Run for your lives, because if he catches you, that's it. The next 30 to 45 minutes are gone. And not that he's telling you about exalted stuff, about Atman and Brahman. Just the general gossip, the news of the day, his opinions on many things. Unstoppable. So be careful. Don't do that. Mahatma Gandhi is to be silent once in a week, one day in a week. Swami Ranganathanji, also one day in a week. Some people practice that way. The best thing is, satyam cha hitam cha mitam cha. The truth, beneficial and minimal. Minimal. Sometimes it is necessary to speak. It's not always that you should not speak. See, a devotee, because we're talking about bhakti, a devotee will say, why should I keep silent? I'll take the name of my beloved Lord. Yes, why should I keep silent? Sometimes it's expected that you will speak. So there you should not keep silent, and so on. But mauni, silence. Santushto yena kena chit. Satisfied with whatever comes in life, and also whoever comes to you in life. I've seen this among senior monks and advanced spiritual seekers. Satisfied with whatever comes your way. Even if it's unexpected, it's not up to what you expected, it's all right. It's all right. I remember a story about Swami Gambhiranandaji, who was the 11th president of our order. So every day in the afternoon, he would have a cup of tea. He was a very revered old Swami, and there was an attendant who would bring his cup of tea with, I think, one spoon of sugar or something. One day, by mistake, he put in a spoon of salt instead of sugar. And when he realized his mistake, he ran to the Swami's quarters, and he found that the Swami had finished the tea. And he would wash the cup and keep it carefully separate. Not a single word of it. He drank the tea and he kept it aside. Santushta yena kena chit. Satisfied with whatever comes your way. Aniketa. Homeless. It's not a problem in India. It's a problem here. Yeah. So homeless means, he's talking about a monastic devotee here. So in order to avoid attachment, they would have this rule that don't spend more than 3 days in a place or a week in a place, like that. I've seen such, there are many such monks even now. They wander across the land without staying in a particular place. They have no fixed abode. So your only attachment is to God, not to a place or a home. Sthiramati. So homeless does not mean the mind is fluctuating. You're moving from place to place, but the mind is not moving from place to place. Mind is firmly set at the feet of the Lord. Or the mind is firmly set in your knowledge that you are Brahman. Sthiramati. It's not good to have a vacillating mind. Some are spiritual tourists. Today Vedanta, tomorrow mindfulness Buddhism, day after tomorrow Sufism, then some new age thing, and then back to Vedanta. And finally, all of this is no good. I really want to be a social media influencer. No. This is sthiramati. Take up a tradition, yes, read whatever you like and learn from everybody, enrich your spiritual life, certainly, but be a spiritual seeker. When Swami Vivekananda, after Sri Ramakrishna's passing, he went to Pavari Bhava, people criticized him. After a guru like Sri Ramakrishna, again, is wandering, going to Pavari Bhava, and Swami Vivekananda wrote a fiery letter saying that I will go to truth wherever it takes me. I follow none but truth. But that's the sincerity of the man. He tested and he found that nobody comes. He said, the great conclusion is there is none like Ramakrishna. So back to Sri Ramakrishna. If you want to be like that, you must have that fiery conviction and pursuit of the truth. Hold on to one thing, either a doctrine, either a practice, or a principle, higher abstract principle like the truth, and be unshakable there. There's a Chinese proverb that flow like water, stand like a rock. Flow like water, stand like a rock. In matters of opinion, flow like water. In matters of principle, stand like a rock. We do the opposite. In matters of opinion, we stand like a rock and fight over social media. Endless fighting, comments and arguments and insults. In matters of principle, we let it go, flow like water. opposite. Sthiramati. Steady. It requires a lifetime. To get a degree requires some time. To raise a family requires decades. To build a career requires years and decades. Spiritual life requires some time. I'm not saying it's very hard, but it is at least as hard as all of these other things. Bhakti man me priyo naraha. Bhakti man. Such a person having devotion for the Lord is very beloved to me, Krishna says. So how to love God and how God loves you. Final conclusion, 20th verse. Yetu dharmyamam ritam idam. Yetu dharmyam ritam idam. Yathoktam paryupasate. Yathoktam paryupasate. Shraddhanamat parama. Shraddhanamat parama. Bhaktasteetiva me priyaha. Bhaktasteetiva me priyaha. Those devotees who practice this nectar-like religion, just taught with faith, and with me as their supreme goal, are extremely dear to me. So, this is a conclusion to the Bhakti Yoga. And we have concluded one whole phase of the Bhagavad Gita. Back again to non-dual Vedanta in the next chapter, 13th chapter. A very profound, very deep chapter is coming up. The field and the knower of the field. Let me do the peace chant. When they take the basket around, we can ask them questions also if you want. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Shri Ram Krishna Rupanamastu. Anybody has a comment? Yes. Yes. Tell us your name. Oh, there's a microphone coming up to you.
Good evening, Swamiji. My name is Madhav.
Yes.
You spoke about the sadhaka's perspective on apamaneo or dishonor being welcomed.
Yes.
So my first question is, if we're being consistent with samaha, why even make the distinction between friend and enemy and honor and dishonor? And my second question...
No, why make the distinction? Because we do. So if you are samaha, you should not. What it's telling us is we do make such a big distinction between friend and enemy. We are nice to our friends, we're nasty to our people we consider our enemies. But if you're going to be loved by God and you're going to love God, you can't do that anymore. We really crave praise and we are very upset with criticism, negativity. But if you're going to be a lover of God, you can't afford to do that anymore. That's the point.
Okay, the second question might slightly contradict the first one, but would it not be a reasonable stance to accept both praise and criticism or reject both praise and criticism?
Accept both or reject both? It's more of being indifferent to it. Having a balanced approach. See, the whole point is, what takes me closer to God? Yeah. What enables me to love God more? So those criticism which help me to reform my character, those criticisms are welcome. Instead of being defensive and angry and... No, welcome. Praise in general is not helpful in any way at all. It's just the opposite of the educational philosophy in this country, now in across the world. You have to continuously praise children, you know. That's how they develop. And the earlier... In contrast to the earlier one where you would continuously criticize the kids. So for little children, yes, it might build up their self-confidence and esteem to a certain degree. But after that, one has to, what is called a reality check. So yeah, praise is hard. For a spiritual seeker who's already expected to be a mature person, emotionally mature internally, you should not be puffed up with praise and deflated and unhappy with criticism. Yeah. Yes, can you pass down the microphone to the gentleman and then we'll come here and finish. tell us your name and ask the question.
Thank you, Swamiji. Pranam is Anjan here from New York. You mentioned something like that we are eternal, and if we lose our own child, son or daughter or parent, they should be considered non-eternal. That I am always eternal and they are non-eternal.
Yeah.
In real practice, if you lose your own son, they also have their divine consciousness in them. So they're also eternal.
Certainly. But the fact that that person was your son or father or mother, husband, wife, that is non-eternal. So only temporarily it was so. That person is actually a spiritual, is a spiritual seeker journeying on the spiritual path. In this particular time, for this tiny period of time, he was with us in one particular relationship. Now the person is gone.
Yeah. But how do you accept
that? So I never said that person is non-eternal. That person certainly is eternal.
Oh, he's eternal.
Yes, but the body is not eternal. The personality is also not eternal.
But to practice vairagya or detachment is extremely hard.
Only because if you want to let go, it's extremely hard. You have to replace it. That's why they replace it with devotion. That love must go somewhere. It should go to God. And in the child, in the husband, wife, father, mother, you see God in them. That was the teaching of generally of Hinduism. See God in the teacher, in the father, mother, and children also, and then serve. So your attitude is of serving of divinity, not setting up relationships with a transient, ever-changing, fallible human creature. So it's a big step. It's not all that easy, but not all that difficult also. I've seen people do it.
Thank you.
You can pass it down to the gentleman here, and we'll stop here.
Hi, thank you for the lecture tonight. It was really, really important to hear. I'm Basil, and I wanted to ask, does it seem that there's more tamas happening in this part of the world, or is it generally...
Part of the world, Manhattan is more rajas. The city that never sleeps. Hmm. I think American Airlines advertisement. You fly to the city that never sleeps, but dreams. Yeah, so Manhattan and the United States in general, if you compare it with other countries, is more rajas, dynamism. In fact, Vivekananda appreciated this when he came to this country more than 100 years ago. He went back and told his countrymen, told us that you learn this from the Westerners, you learn this from Americans and Europeans. Bring in this power of, energy, dynamism. Yes, it may lead to, initially, to ambition and greed, but better than tamas, better than being inert and lazy and... So tamas to rajas, rajas to sattva. The goal is sattva. Religion is not possible in either of them, tamas or rajas. Tamas leads to destruction. One slips lower and lower. Rajas leads to some amount of worldly prosperity and development, dynamism. Sattva leads to prosperity in this world also, but especially the possibility of higher life. It leads to art and science and especially to spirituality. All right, you can shout out your question. We have run out of time.
In terms of honor, are we not supposed to focus on doing honorable things?
No, do honorable things. Just don't do it for getting the praise of people. Now I do it as a spiritual practice. Of course one must do honorable things. But getting on, the goal should not be people will praise me. Initially, people will praise you, but don't do it for that. Don't do it for that. If you do it for that, very soon you will find that praise is pretty flimsy, as you see in today's social media age. Today praise, tomorrow it will be condemned. And day after tomorrow praise, and then a day after that totally forgotten and the world has gone ahead. And you're left with your head spinning, what happened to my life? So it's pretty flimsy. Don't even look back at it. Like Ramana Maharshi said, some fellow called Ramana is being criticized. No attachment at all to that little personality. We are speaking about very high, very deep things here. All right, good. Thank you so much.